imagine there's no heaven. Seems if you try, no hell below us. Above us, only sky. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought. On this program, we promote humanism, which is founded on rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism, which we use to explore ways to create positive social change. Today, in studio, our guest is Tina Kelly, former staff writer at the New York Times and co-author of the topic of today's show, Almost Home, Helping Kids Move from Homelessness to Hope. Hi, Tina.
Hi, Matt. Nice to be here.
Good to have you on. It's always nice to have somebody in the studio. It makes things a lot easier. We actually get to have a conversation face-to-face, and I think it's great for listeners to hear it. So before we get to the book, Almost Home, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, and I was in journalism for 20 years. I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Seattle Times, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and for the last 10 years of my journalism career at the New York Times. I worked in the Metro Bureau, the Metro Department, entirely during those 10 years. And at the last year or so of it, I was doing a hyperlocal blog about Maplewood, Millburn, and South Orange, New Jersey.
Oh, cool. Well, this show actually goes out there too. We have it goes out to most of New Jersey, goes out to New York, and it goes out to Brooklyn, a little bit of Connecticut. So it's nice to have a little bit of that space there. So you wrote this book alongside of Kevin Ryan, the president of Covenant House. Tell us a little bit about what Covenant House is, and then how you came to co-author this book.
Covenant House is the largest charity organization that works with homeless, runaway, and trafficked young people. We serve 56,000 young people a year in 6 countries. We're in 15 cities in the United States and 2 in Canada and 4 countries in Latin America. I came to write the book because I had known Kevin Ryan when I was covering children's issues in New Jersey for the Times, and I wrote about his work reforming the child welfare system. He was in charge of the reforms of foster care. And as he left to go be the head of Covenant House, and we were speaking at one point about his desire to get a book going that would describe the transformations that happen in young people's lives. He had worked at Covenant House in the earlier part of his career, and I had volunteered at Covenant House when I was right out of college.
Oh, okay.
And so I was very sympathetic to the mission to begin with. And he had seen kids that he'd worked with the first part of his career years later emerging as very flourishing young adults, able to have their own families and raise their own children with love and have successful careers. And he would remember how they had come into the shelter so beaten down and so in need of any kind of hope. He wanted to get the stories across of how they went from point A to point B.
So since that time, how do you think that the prevalence of homeless youth in the United States has changed over, let's say, the past 30 years or so?
Oof. It's hard to get figures on homeless young people. We were trying to trace the increase in the numbers just since the recession, and it's very hard to do. When young people are homeless, they don't want to be known. They don't want to be seen as homeless. They don't want to be counted. If someone knows that you're without a place to stay, you're much more likely to be exploited by them. And we found that trafficked young people are almost predominantly homeless because the pimps and the traffickers realize that they will say yes to an offer of a place to stay because they don't have many choices.
And how does that happen? Do they just kind of come up to you on the street and tell, you know, them what business they're in and then just try and hire them that way?
Or no,
what?
No.
Did anyone tell you sort of a story about how they got involved in something like prostitution?
Yeah. It's insidious. A lot of the young people that I've spoken to talk about one woman in particular who I interviewed for the book but didn't get into the book said that she was walking down the street one night and had had a fight with her sister and was, you know, really without a clear place to go. Some guy drove by and said, "Hey, Tiffany, you look great tonight." And her name wasn't Tiffany, but he started flirting with her and he asked her to a movie. So she jumped in the car and, you know, over the course of a very short period of time, they got romantic and he soon turned her out for tricks. Mm. She basically said she was bought for the cost of a hot dog.
Wow.
A lot of the young people in that situation, and it's not just women, but young men as well, haven't been told that they are beautiful or lovable or valuable. And if someone comes in and pretends to be their love interest, even for a short period of time, they get entrapped in that life.
So it seems like that's just one of many stories. How many people did you end up interviewing, and then how did you decide which stories to talk about in the book?
Over the course of the book, I think we interviewed about 200 people. To find the kids that we finally ended up focusing on, the six kids in the book, it was a process of about 6 months. We talked to a number of kids, all of whom would have made wonderful chapters in the story. We had to focus it on a right mix. We needed to make sure that we covered certain aspects of homelessness that are front and center in our work. So we needed someone who'd been through the foster care system, someone who was kicked out of their home for being gay, someone who was a young parent, someone who'd been trafficked. And we had to get the right mix geographically and racially and genderly and all that. So it was quite a process.
And it must have been a little bit challenging. I mean, I know that you've had a lot of experience in reporting and in reporting stories that are not necessarily easy to tell or easy to talk to the people who have to go through things like this. How did you manage to go through all of these interviews with all of these kids and stay positive, knowing that, you know, you get the opportunity to interview some success stories, mm-hmm. but also recognizing the fact that there are many out there who continue to have these struggles and are not necessarily at the point of having any sort of success, any sort of life other than being homeless and living in a really unfortunate circumstance?
I did it in the entirely wrong order, it turns out. The first chapter I reported on ended up being a very short page or two in the book, but it was about a young man who, before we started the reporting, had committed suicide. And I interviewed everyone in the shelter who knew him and his friends and his work buddies. And eventually, and I wrote up a whole chapter, but his family did not want him in the book, so he's not in the book. After that reporting, which was very depressing, I found that everybody else that I was speaking to was a lot easier to speak to. It was a lot more cheering of me, you know, because they were there, they were had smiles on their faces, they had emerged as vibrant young adults who were basically at that point attaining their dreams, most of them. And they put me at ease incredibly. They were so generous with their time and so generous with their patience when we had follow-up question after follow-up question.
Yeah. I bet there were a lot of questions.
Yes.
that you had to go through. And how did these kids end up? When I was reading the book, it struck me as somewhat surprising that these kids and even some of their friends and relatives opened up so much,
mm-hmm.
and were willing to share such stories with you.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything you really had to do other than just ask them questions that led them to open up, or was it just sort of part of their personality? Of course, I assume each person was probably slightly different than the other.
Yeah, the main thing that comes to mind in that regard is the huge generosity that was shown to me by the family at the first and last chapter of the book is the story of Polly, who was in and out of Covenant House shelters 11 times before the message that he was worth investing in himself and that he had a bright future finally sunk in. And at the end of the book, he meets his birth mother, who he hadn't met, he hadn't seen in 22 years. And he told us that his birth mother had found him while we were reporting his interesting story about him and his homelessness. And we said, can we be there for that? Can we join you when you meet your birth mother? And he said, sure. So I flew out to Chicago, and, you know, they met each other at the baggage claim of Delta at O'Hare International Airport. And I hung out with them for, I think, 3 days as they got to know each other. And they were so generous to allow a stranger into that situation. But at the end, the birth mother thanked me for being there. And that's what really knocked my socks off. But I think in part, I was asking her son questions that she might wanted to have known the answer to, but I was asking them instead of her. So she got to hear a lot of his story because I was asking him follow-up questions from earlier interviews. I think it might have made it a little easier for them, I hope.
Yeah. Well, I know that you obviously, considering the fact that this is a book, and we certainly want people to purchase this book. In fact, I was reading on the back that the proceeds from the sale will help the kids who benefit from Covenant House's shelter and outreach services.
Right.
So it's definitely also a good buy aside from the writing. But why don't you tell us a little bit about, you were just talking about Polly. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about Polly's story?
Well, Polly was adopted by a family when he was 2.5, and he grew up hearing the story that his birth mother had abandoned him in a shed in Alaska when he was 6 months old, and basically that she had left him to die. And his adoptive family had a lot of challenges. There was domestic violence, there was addiction, and the family split when he was 13. His mother went to Canada, and he was left in the lurch. He tried to follow his mother at one point, but he didn't fit in there. He and his father didn't get along well, and he was lost. He didn't believe in himself. He didn't want to go to school because he didn't have clean clothes or stylish clothes. He didn't have a place to stay clean. So he ended up on the streets. He ended up addicted to ecstasy. He had trouble with the law. He had a psychiatric hospitalization. And, you know, when he was 15, he ended up at the steps of Covenant House in Anchorage. There he met a counselor who was his nemesis, but also his lifesaver. And she gave him the tough love that he needed, but also the love to see that he was worth it, that he should start believing in himself and get his GED and bring his life, you know, into line and get off the drugs and stop leaving to go back to the street because he loved the independence there. He'd come back to rejuvenate and then leave again to go back to the street. So he was in and out of the shelter 11 times. And I'm not going to tell the end.
I can understand. See, that's why people have to get the book. Well, I'm also wondering, too, how do you think that people who work at Covenant House, who are working directly with these kids all the time, did you get any sense as to how they interact with them? In other words, you were mentioning that she gave him some tough love.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, how does one decide what approach to take, considering it's so hard to, unless you grew up in a situation similar to theirs, it's so hard to imagine what it would really feel like from that person's perspective. And how do we decide how to approach these kids when, you know, if you give them some tough love and they react in a way that that you don't like, but then sometimes if you just kind of lay back and just support them in a kinder way, they also don't really take it too seriously. How do you decide which direction to go?
I have the utmost respect for the people who work there. It is incredibly challenging. But the basic tenet of Covenant House is to treat kids with unconditional love and respect. And they also work under the premise that the kids have choice. They have free will. They can make decisions to go back to the street, and Covenant House can't do anything about it. The kids are there voluntarily, and they have to follow their own paths and make their own decisions. So there are times when, in the case of Muriel, the young trafficking victim in British Columbia, at one point she decided to go back to prostitution. And it was heartbreaking for her counselors. But they knew that she had to live her own life. And as she was leaving, someone said to her, "You're better than that. You know, you have the free will to go, but just keep in mind that you're better than that. You deserve better than that." And she can't remember who said it to her. It was somebody at the shelter. I talked to all of her counselors and said, "Did you say that?" Because someone really made a big impression on her. They couldn't remember, but it was the one sentence that brought her back. I think it was the fifth time for her when she realized that she needed to get, you know, on a better path, on a path that would validate her and let her, you know, accomplish her dreams.
That sentence that she heard may have been sort of a culmination of what people at Covenant House had been telling her during the time that she was there. That's sort of the impression that I got from reading that quote. It sounded like it was something that probably she thought to herself a number of times and, you know, brought out by the help of the people who were working at Covenant House. And it's really a nice thing to hear that some of these stories can turn out fairly well. Do you have any insight, I should say, into why it is that someone who was abused a number of times dealing with prostitution in that industry, why they would want to go back?
Well, in her case, she had serious troubles with a drug addiction, and they kept her on cocaine, on a mixture of cocaine and the date rape drug. So she craved the cocaine, but they also spiked her cocaine so that she would keep working. And it's a very difficult cycle to break, because if you get a person in that situation who's addicted and trafficked, if you get them to stop being addicted, they don't have any other way to make a living necessarily. Then all of a sudden they see the ugliness of the situation they've been in more clearly. But they also oftentimes have love relationships with the people who are exploiting them, a la Stockholm syndrome. So you have to break away the addiction as well as the exploitation at the same time. And it's a really big challenge.
And how do we compare in the United States to other countries around the world in terms of our issue with prostitution, particularly regarding minors?
You know, there are countries that are certainly worse off than we are. The State Department issues a report of every country in the United States and in the world and ranks them according to how they're doing with child trafficking. And you know, the United States is as a first world country is doing okay, but not as well as it should be. The common misperception that people have is that if you have a trafficking victim, he or she is most likely someone from another country who's been trafficked across lines. That's not the case. A trafficking victim, by definition, is someone under 18 who's been made to participate in commercial sex, or someone over 18 who's been made to participate in commercial sex through force, fraud, or coercion. So 83% of trafficking victims, according to one group of studies by the FBI, are U.S. citizens. And a ton of them are homeless kids, because people recruit homeless kids. People hang out in front of homeless shelters looking for kids who don't have a place to go. And sometimes they send recruiters into the shelters and say, "Look, you know, you could have your own apartment. You could have your glamorous clothes. You could have this and that. You don't have to share a room in a shelter. You don't have a curfew." And they sell it to look like a glamorous lifestyle.
I wish that we could find a way to be able to interview the people who are doing that part of it.
I know.
And I don't just mean that in a way of just trying to exploit the sort of disgustingness of the whole situation. But I wonder what on earth could be going through their minds that that makes them okay with doing this.
Well, it's what goes through our society's mind. There's a huge glorification of the pimp culture. I read an amazing book by Julian Cher called Somebody's Daughters, and it just went on about how singers and our culture in general glorifies the pimp. Yeah. They have the pimp ball where people, you know, have the Pimp of the Year award, and they have off-duty cops providing security there.
Right. Well, it's so hard to tell in those types of situations how people are really taking it and how people are really understanding it, because I don't think that if someone who, let's say, enjoys that part of culture, if you explain to them the kind of stories that, right. that you write about in right. the book, I don't suspect that many of them would still feel as if it's okay. I almost feel as if there's two different ways of looking at it in, mm-hmm. in the same way that comedians can often make jokes about a complete disaster, mm-hmm. while on the other hand recognizing the serious problem with it. And mm-hmm. I kind of wonder where the disconnect is there between taking it either too seriously or not taking it seriously at all.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how other countries do that, because there's something called the Nordic model regarding laws about prostitution. And in those countries, including Israel and Norway and Denmark, it's not illegal to be a prostituted person. It's illegal to take money or to pay money for sex. But if you have, in those situations, the Johns and the pimps are the ones who get arrested. The women, predominantly women, who are prostituted are not the ones who are criminalized. And because they recognize that they need social services and safe shelter and health care and job training, and that if it weren't for the demand, which is because of the men who are willing to buy women, there would be far fewer prostitutes out there.
Mm. And how does the United States so far, how are we dealing with this problem? Obviously, Covenant House can't solve all of the homeless problems in the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you see anything that the United States, the federal government, is doing to help in this crisis, or maybe state, local governments?
It's starting to become, the solutions are coming slowly. It's sort of like when people looked at the domestic violence situation in the 70s, and now police are trained to recognize signs of domestic violence and to bring people in even if the victim doesn't want to testify. That's slowly happening with prostitution. They're training law enforcement officials around the country to see the signs of trafficking, whether it means instead of arresting a person who's being prostituted, asking them questions. Are they okay? Do they feel safe? Do they need health care? Are they being coerced? Those kinds of questions take a long time and a lot of trust before you can get the right answers to. That's why it's so hard to count trafficking victims. And we found that at Covenant House. No one comes in and says, "Hi, I've been trafficked. I need help."
Yeah.
It
yeah.
takes, you know, months before someone would trust enough to tell those dark secrets.
Do you have any idea exactly how that process works? Because I was wondering the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like trying to figure out how many people are engaging in some sort of illegal activity, mm-hmm. when the most people who are participating in that illegal activity wouldn't report it.
Right.
I wonder how that sort of information comes through, or is it just kind of a stab in the dark?
The numbers are very hard to come by, because a lot of times if a trafficked person is arrested, she'll be told not to give her right name or her right age, you know, or be threatened with being beaten. So it takes long, sensitive conversations, which don't always happen yet. So if you're training law enforcement officials to look at them as victims rather than as criminals, that'll be a great step forward.
So let's talk a little bit about Covenant House, mm-hmm. as an organization. Why don't you tell us again just a little bit about what Covenant House does, how it started?
Okay. This is our 40th year. It was founded in 1972 by a Franciscan priest who was opening up apartments to homeless kids in the Lower East Side. And it has grown from, you know, an apartment or two to, you know, serving thousands, or actually I think 2 million at this point served since those years. I look at it as a greenhouse where kids who have come in can find what they need to thrive. So the first step is to make sure that their physical needs are met, that they have a shower, that they have a safe place to sleep, that they have clean clothes, and that they're fed. 30% of them need medical care, so we take care of that right away. And once they've gotten those needs met, they are assigned to a counselor who helps them develop a plan and talks to them about what they want to happen next. In some cases, they can be reunited with their families or with another family member. If that can be done safely, then we'll counsel them and their families through that reuniting. But in most cases, they need either to get their GED, they need to get, some of them go back to high school, some of them can get into college. A lot of them need either a full-time or part-time job, and the end result is getting them into independent living. We have a transitional living program called Rites of Passage, where the kids, once they've gotten a job and apply to this program, they can stay for, you know, up to 2 years, depending on their age, and learn life skills, learn budgeting, put a certain percentage of their income into escrow. So when it's time for them to find their own apartment, they have a nest egg and can go and pay first and last month's rent and get themselves established. So that has a pretty high success rate.
And is it particularly hard in any of the areas that Covenant House currently works? For example, is it harder for a kid who goes to a Covenant House in New York, let's say, to come out, be able to get a job, live on their own, than it is, let's say, in the one in Los Angeles?
It really varies. Like right now, I think one of the hardest places to be would be Atlantic City, because our shelter was underwater with Hurricane Sandy. Yeah. They're still in the process of rebuilding, and the economy down there is in the process of rebuilding. Our young mother, who was a Katrina refugee in New Orleans, found a terrible time getting affordable housing because the hurricane had taken such a huge chunk of New Orleans affordable housing. And in Anchorage, you know, you have to worry about just staying warm. So the economies vary from city to city. We have a Covenant House in Detroit, where it's got to be hard to find a living wage and an entry-level job. But a lot of our shelters have training programs that can lead directly to a job. We have training in food services and construction and lawn care and a number of trades that kids can get into, and which make it much easier for them to afford life on their own.
Right. And I understand, too, that, you know, it's not just a matter of being able to find a job.
Right.
Because, yeah, that's definitely a start. Mm-hmm. But the way that the economy is right now, mm-hmm. that's not only a big challenge, but also it seems very strange that the amount of money that a person can make in an entry-level job mm-hmm. to start with mm-hmm. Is so absurdly low.
Yes.
That I cannot imagine how somebody would be able to do it. Actually, I wanna read a passage here that you have, unless you want to read it, Tina.
I'll read it.
It might sound good coming from your voice. She wrote it, after all. So right here, right on 115 here, you talk a little bit about the about what kids have to go through, the money issue.
I knew what page you were looking for.
Yeah, you know your book well.
Your average teenager doesn't know this. Say you get pregnant or get someone pregnant and you have a baby. Nearly 750,000 American teenage girls do every year. A third of them are under 18. Almost 90% of teen mothers are unmarried. You need a place to live, but to afford your average two-bedroom apartment, you need a job that pays $18.46 an hour. To afford that apartment on a minimum wage, you need to work more than 20 hours each weekday. And to keep that job, you have to find childcare. But in 36 states, a year of childcare costs more than a year in a state college. And of course, childcare for those 20-hour days would cost much more.
Is there kind of a point where you were writing this book and your computer, you almost threw your computer across the room? Because in reading that particular sentence, I was just thinking about how absurd that is.
Yeah. I never got discouraged to the point where I would stop, because I knew it was so important to get the message out. But when I hear of young people that I've interviewed who become pregnant after I've interviewed them, not anyone in the book, but other young people, your heart breaks, because they are just so at risk of teetering off the edge without a second mouth to feed.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't remember exactly when the last time the minimum wage was raised in the United States, and I don't remember by how much, mm-hmm. but I know that it is just an impossibility mm-hmm. to be able to function, even without a child, mm-hmm. Living on minimum wage in New York, for right. example. I think it's $7.45 or $7.75, somewhere around there, and that just seems impossible
right.
to be able to live on, and it would make sense that over time, we may find that we're going to have more and more people showing up to places like Covenant House. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how... I know that Covenant House certainly has an open door policy, and you know, children can come in. But do you think that we will possibly get to a point where there's just not enough room? We can't have another bed.
Right, right. Well, we found with Hurricane Sandy, we ran outreach vans to Queens and the areas along the shore. There were hundreds and hundreds of new homeless people just from that one event. So there is going to be a time when there's no room at the inn.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who are just tuning in, I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm here with Tina Kelly, the former New York Times reporter and co-author of the book Almost Home, Helping Kids Move from Homelessness to Hope. Maybe we can spend a little bit more time talking about the hope and see what we can do about that.
Right.
In the last chapter of the book, you talk a little bit about what people can do, mm-hmm. Either at home on their computer or other options that they can use to help these kids. What are some of those examples?
Well, they range from tiny to huge. I'll start with tiny. We found that a lot of the kids in our shelter have never had their own birthday cake. They were raised in foster care or by parents who either couldn't or wouldn't take care of them. And they never had that kind of attention and love that they needed. So we've had volunteers come in and bake cakes for kids, have movie nights, carve pumpkins, do Easter egg hunts, a lot of things that sound childish, but we've been surprised by how much the young people love that because they missed out so much on their childhoods. The greatest thing that someone, I think, can do is adopt a child and keep them out of foster care, out of, the dangers of the streets. There are examples of that in the book where Keith's foster mother adopts him and his two brothers and made a huge, huge difference in his life. There are a lot of things that can be done on a policy level. And what gives me the most hope from this book is that we do know how to reduce and practically end youth homelessness. There are a number of steps that can be taken that have been proven in smaller localities that if they were taken national could work wonders in reducing the flow of kids to our doors. And predominantly that would be going back upstream to the foster care system, making sure that kids don't age out of foster care at 18 or at 21 with no permanent families of their own. Each year, 26,000 young Americans find themselves in that situation where the foster care system says, thanks for your time, go off and have a nice life. And nobody I know was ever in any state to take care of themselves at age 18. And those are people who were, brought up in stable homes predominantly. If you were moving from placement to placement, as some of our young people did, one young man in the book was at 35 different placements before he reached age 18. You miss school, you fall behind in school, you lose 6 months of schooling for each time you move in a foster care placement. Mm. They are not equipped to be on their own. So there are ways to encourage people to adopt the kids who've been in foster care the longest. That was an initiative that Kevin Ryan did when he was in charge of foster care in New Jersey, and they had good results with that. There's another way of keeping kids out of foster care in the first place, which is called differential response, where teams of social workers work with the families to see what they need to keep themselves together, what kind of wraparound services are required to keep a kid from being taken from the home. And if there are fewer kids in foster care, there are fewer kids aging out into homelessness. There's another way of helping kids find adoptive families, which is called extreme family finding. And it's worked in St. Louis quite dramatically. They take young kids who are just coming into the foster care system and assign them a retired detective who will go around the region finding long-distance relatives of each child in foster care. Huh. So not just the mothers and the grandmothers and the aunts and uncles, but the great-aunts and the second cousins who oftentimes, when they find out that one of their kin is in foster care, they'll say, well, I'd rather take them in. So the kids who are just in regular foster care have a 40% placement rate into adoptive families, but kids who've had extreme family finding and their own detective, they have a 70% rate of finding a permanent home. So that's just in St. Louis at this point, but if that were universalized, you could reduce the number of kids in foster care greatly. And that's important because we found, it's not in the book, but it's a figure that just blew me away, was that kids who've been in foster care have higher rates, have twice the rate of PTSD as returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. That it is way more traumatic to be pulled from your home and your school and your family and your town than it is to be in a battlefield.
Yeah. Well, and I think I started to grasp a little bit better the idea, the point of why it is that some of these kids end up in a position where they continue to rely on their faith. And that's something I want to get into, especially on this show. Covenant House is certainly not an organization that they're not one of those organizations that says, yes, you can come in, but first you must read this passage of the Bible.
Right.
You know, nothing like that. But certainly they do have a Christian angle, I would say. Can you talk a little bit about how they handle religion in Covenant House, and if at all they communicate that with the kids that come through their doors?
Well, historically, because we were founded by a priest who went from church to church telling the stories of homeless kids, our donor base is very heavily religious, and we have pastors available in the shelters for the kids if they request it, if they need it. It's available to them, but they can go through the shelter system without ever having to have any of that. A lot of them take advantage of it. But I've been fascinated to hear the kids talk about their relationships with God, because some of them have been angry at God at times and blaming God, and others giving God all the credit. So they think about it a lot. I've listened to some of the raps that they've written about God, and it's a big part of their lives. It gives them strength. And it also, I think, inspires and gives energy to the donors to Covenant House, and also to a lot of the workers there have strong faiths of varying kinds.
Yeah.
We have people of all denominations. But the main purpose is to help these kids grow into their full potential, which is just a basic value across any religion and across humanism.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of one thing that I think a lot of times people get a little bit put off by, just because, for example, if there are people, and I'm sure that there probably are, people who are listening to the program right now who are of not any particular religion at all, you know, and they like the work that Covenant House does. They like the idea of helping these kids end up in good places in life, but they are a little bit nervous that some of the money is going towards, let's say, the pastors who are coming by and, you know, talking directly to these kids, or perhaps they're concerned about some of the workers who they themselves came there out of not only a feeling of I want to do something good, but out of, you know, this is what God has sent me to do. And I always get a little bit concerned about how it might feel to people who don't necessarily believe in a supreme being to be surrounded by organizations like Covenant House, but feel almost as if they're almost left out. You know, if somebody decides they want to donate to an organization that helps homeless kids, you know, it's somewhat frustrating, I think, for many of us that we look at one organization and then we say, oh, but, you know, they're doing this, that, the other thing. You know, where's a place for the humanist? Where's a place for the atheist? And I always wondered why it is that organizations who do such good work tend to be more founded on something that's related to spirituality and the Bible, rather than just doing good things for the sake of doing good things.
Well, I can talk about a young man who came to Covenant House with huge hostility towards religion. He had been kicked out of his house for being gay, and his family had a religious basis for that. And he came to the Covenant House in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, and was met with a nun there. She wasn't in a full habit, but her job was to work with homeless kids. And at first he thought, hey, I don't know if I want to go back to the to what bit me.
Right.
And it turned for him. He saw the work she did and the love that she gave him and the encouragement and what she did for other kids as well of all different faiths and or non-faiths. And it brought him closer to his original faith in the long run. We've had kids who are just very, very angry at God. But we also, you know, a lot of these organizations are founded by religious people, I think, because those religious people, particularly, you know, Franciscans and nuns, are out to serve the poor. That's what they do all day long.
Right.
That's their mission. And, you know, it's they're the ones who are finding those organizations because that's what they do all day.
Yeah. Well, and I think it creates a big challenge for people who don't believe in some sort of supreme being, just mm-hmm. because I think it would be a lot harder to found for example, some sort of covenant house that was, you know, the humanist version of covenant mm-hmm. house or the atheist version of covenant mm-hmm. house. You know, I think it would be a lot harder, even though, you know, as long as the work that people are doing is good, mm-hmm. as long as they're helping these kids, I can't figure out why it is that these particular beliefs always kind of end up going in to that kind of work. It may inspire people to do this kind of work,
mm-hmm.
but I think that there are many people out there who would be just as willing to do the same work, but mm-hmm. without necessarily having that other attachment. And I just wonder how people feel about an organization like Covenant House if they're coming from a perspective other than Christianity, and if, like you were explaining about that child who came out to his parents as homosexual, I also wonder if there are kids like him who they may not end up turning back around to finding their original faith that they grew up with, but you know, maybe it scares them, it turns them away.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't figure out why it is that it can't just be about, you know, again, doing good for the sake of doing good.
Right. Well,
you can't obviously answer these questions because, you know, this is more kind of a discussion at this point. But
I mean, I think
it confuses me.
I think if there was a secular humanists organization that had thousands of people in it and had a mission of go and serve the poor, then you would see that.
Right.
Christianity has that built in from 2,000 years back.
Right.
But I do know that love has no real flavor of faith to it. These kids come in having been unloved and actively beaten down by their families, by their circumstances, through no fault of their own. And when they are approached with a sense of unconditional love and respect, which cuts across all religions and also secular humanism, when they're approached with that love, they don't question what flavor love it is. They are able to sort of grow and blossom because someone believes in them. And that's what people are believing in mostly day to day, is believing in the kids and their abilities to, you know, meet their potential and have the life that they deserve.
What was it that that woman said in the book? There's a quote that you use from her, and I wonder if you remember it exactly, but it had something to do with this almost directly, just saying that it doesn't matter. You know,
I don't know Jesus personally, but I don't think he makes people want to come in, and I don't think he requires people pray before they get help.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always a big problem. And I know that there actually are a number of, churches that do things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again, not saying Covenant House is
right,
a church,
right.
But I know there are a lot of, groups
mm-hmm.
that will do that sort of thing. And I think that's where, you know, that's where we run into some serious problems, but it's certainly a struggle and something to think about,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, at what point does one draw the line between, you know, pushing a particular view versus just utilizing that view to help people? And
mm-hmm.
I guess that the only time it ever feels like pushing is if the person doesn't believe that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's sort of the only time that changes. But so with these kids, has there been any updates since the release? I know it hasn't been out too terribly long. A couple of
right, it came out October 1st.
Yeah, so just a couple months.
So let's see. Yes, there have been. We did quite a comprehensive book tour and visited a lot of the different shelters where the kids were, and got some updates on them. But I guess we say in the book at the end, there's a little update section.
Yeah.
So Benjamin got married. Crayana is actually in the process of considering buying her own home. Mm. She has a car again.
That's great.
When I spoke with her, I was just blown away by the way she had to take 7 different rides on public transportation to get through her day.
Yeah.
To get to drop off the baby, to get to work, to get to school, to pick up the baby, to get back home.
It's
and,
unbelievable.
Just how many hours that took out of her schedule, which had no room to spare.
Yep.
So she has her own car, and she actually has joined the board of a charity that works with disadvantaged people in New Orleans. So she's becoming a leader in her community already. Oh, I just heard from Polly this week, and he had been working in the restaurant industry and doing quite well, heading towards a management position, training for a management position, going to college online. But he said this week that he was going to be working with chemically dependent homeless people, that the restaurant industry didn't hold his heart anymore, and he wanted to go back and give back, which gave me shivers. And I immediately emailed Kevin and said, look what's going on.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
So many of the young people want to give back. It was, I think, to a person, each of the ones that we spent so much time with, they felt lucky to have made it, and they wanted to help other people do the same.
I noticed that was a common theme throughout mm-hmm. the book. That, as a matter of fact, many of the people that came to work at Covenant House ended up having similar backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really good that seems to be what happens to the people that come out. Do you know anything about how many people we have currently that are still struggling with this problem in terms of just number-wise in the United States?
Yeah, it's tough, but what we say in the book is that 2 million young Americans a year experience at least one episode of homelessness.
Mm. Oh, and I think it said that, 240,000 to 400,000 were homosexual?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that range?
Yeah, it's 40% in some cities.
That one's actually really one of the most remarkable statistics to me, just because if we're dealing with about, you said, 2 million uh-huh. nationwide per year,
uh-huh.
to have such a large chunk, even let's say it's just at the lower level of 240,000 mm-hmm. a year that are homosexual, that seems to be such a shock to me.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's a way to know if the reason they're homeless is due to the unfortunately too common story of the parent finds out that the kid is gay and then they throw them out,
mm-hmm.
or if it's just, it's just they were homeless and they also happened to be homosexual. I don't really know if there's any way of determining that.
There's small studies that have parsed that out, but what I found so exciting in our research for this book was that there was a woman in San Francisco who's running what's called the Family Acceptance Project. Her name is Caitlin Ryan, and she's at the University of California in San Francisco. And what she was able to discover was a list of behaviors that parents show to their kids when their kids come out. Mm-hmm. And she divided them among positive behaviors and negative behaviors. And not surprisingly, the kids whose parents were incredibly accepting did tons better than the kids whose families were incredibly rejecting. But the kids whose families were kind of rejecting but kind of accepting did twice as well as the kids whose families were very rejecting. So there's room for distributing that list of positive behaviors to families who are struggling with the issue of their kids just coming out. It's not that the parents don't love them. It's that the parents are trying to protect them and are oftentimes trying to protect them in ways that don't feel right to the young person. So they'll say, I want you to stay safe, so stop acting the way you're acting. Don't be so gay. And because I don't want you to get beaten up. But to the child, that sounds terrible. It sounds like they're rejecting their very core. But Dr. Ryan found that if they do just a couple things from the list of positive behaviors, like take the young person to be mentored by someone who's gay and has a positive life so they can see that it gets better. Take the young person's friends into the home and make them feel welcome there. Go with the young person to school if they're getting bullied and stand up for them. Just, you know, the one or two of those behaviors can make a huge difference, can double the chances that the child will do well afterwards. Because once gay kids are on the street, they are far more at risk of being trafficked, of being beaten up and raped, of committing suicide. It's very, very risky for them out there.
Yeah.
And we try at Covenant House to be as welcome as possible. And even in some cases, there was one shelter that created a wing for kids who were transgender where they would feel safe sleeping amongst themselves rather than potentially getting beat up or teased by their peers. So there's that way of approaching kids with unconditional love that really comes through in those situations.
And I know that many people are aware of these types of tragedies in the United States, but was there anything in particular that you learned while writing this book? And I'm not talking about specifics or statistics. You know, online research, obviously we all learn that way, but anything that really has struck you throughout your interviews and throughout writing your book?
I was blown away by a lot of different things. First off, that the kids who were in these situations were almost uniformly in those situations through no fault of their own. You know, people might look at homeless teenagers in a train station or hanging on a street corner and find them threatening or think they might have made bad choices to get to where they were. But what I found was that you can't help it if you're 2 and your mother dies and then your dad goes to jail when you're 7. You can't help it if you were adopted into a family that was highly dysfunctional. You can't help it if you were born with fetal alcohol syndrome. All of these circumstances, no little baby would come into this planet and sign up for. But that's what happened to them. And the strength and the kindness that they show. The second thing that blew me away was how easy they were to talk to, how friendly and generous with their time. One young woman would call to make sure I'd gotten home okay after interviewing her. And their ways of giving back, that was also eye-opening for me. Another thing was how it didn't take much at all to turn a life around in some situations, particularly with Crayana when she's crying in the Walmart parking lot with her 6-week-old baby with nowhere to go. And that elderly couple came up to her and said, you know, why are you crying? What can we do? And she said, could you drive me to the shelter? Because the buses had stopped running. Those people changed her life forever. She is an amazing mother, an amazing member of society, amazing caregiver. And she could easily have ended up dead that night or trafficked or separated forever from her kid. And it was the kindness of strangers that Cory Booker talks about so well in the foreword, that these small acts of kindness make such a huge difference, that so often we get discouraged because we think, oh, we can't solve youth homelessness. But we can take that one step that would make one kid's day and maybe help them trust another person going forward.
And we don't even know who those people were.
Mm-mm. No, she doesn't have their names. Nope. And they may never think about it, you know? That might have just been something that they would do on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And matter of fact, you know, I get the impression that sometimes it is just some particular people, you know, that who are willing to do the most simple thing can really make a difference. And I would end by saying that can help in all walks of life, homeless or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just doing those small acts of kindness can really help somebody and sometimes even change their lives.
And if you need inspiration for that, there's chapter 8 of this book because we
See?
Put a lot of those in there.
There you go. Yeah, and I want to stress the fact that we didn't talk too much about the specific stories in the book, but we did that for a reason. It's so you, the listener, will buy the book. Again, as I said before, the proceeds from the sale of the book will help support kids who benefit from Covenant House's shelter and outreach services. So buy this book. It's great. It's available on Amazon. It's available
Barnes and Noble. At almosthomethebook.org.
Yes. Which is also is a nice website because you get to look a little bit at some of the examples, some of the kids and sort of a brief description of their profiles and, mm-hmm. and who they are and what they've gone through. So it's been great to have you on the show today. Thanks for coming. Again, the book is Almost Home, Helping Kids Move from Homelessness to Hope. And for those of you who may have missed part of this program or you'd like to share it with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Thanks to our engineer, Ian, who is over there hard at work, my guest, Tina Kelly, and remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.
Sing. Homeless, homeless, moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake. Homeless, homeless, moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake.
And we are
homeless.
We are
homeless. The moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
And we are
homeless.
Homeless.
We are homeless.
Homeless.
The moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
See your yummy.
See your
yummy.
See your yummy.
See your yummy.
See your
yummy.
See your yummy.
See your yummy.
See your yummy.
See your yummy.
See your yummy. See your yummy.
Equal Time for Free Thought returns next week Saturday between 3 and 4. Coming up momentarily will be Afrobeat Radio, strains of Paul Simon here, 25 Years of Graceland, a phenomenal production on PBS recently. Loved watching it, and you get the opportunity to see it again if you go to PBS Great Concerts. Homeless, one of the tracks from that album.